How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no. So that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. Was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And
look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Julia Baird is a journalist. You might have read her work in the Fairfax papers or heard her on Sunday Profile on ABC Radio. Julia is back living in Australia after an extended stint in the United States, where she became deputy editor of the prestigious Newsweek magazine in what was perhaps its final years of glory. Julia's timing as a journalist was good in the sense that Newsweek was an exciting place to be. America was about to go through a fascinating and transformative moment. Julia saw the rise of Barack Obama, the collapse of the long boom, and sadly, in the end, Newsweek itself. Julia's always been fascinated about women in power. She covered the political supernova that was Sarah Palin, and almost despite herself, she found herself liking and even admiring the Alaskan governor, kinda, sorta, for a while anyway. Now she's buried herself in the process of writing a biography of a seriously misunderstood woman of power, Queen Victoria. Wow. Hello, Julia.
Hello there.
Why write a biography of Queen Victoria?
Because I wanted to tell her story again, and because I feel that she's a woman who's been hidden in plain sight for centuries, you know. And I spent a lot of time reading about her before I decided to commit to the book, and really decided that her experience as a working mother, her kind of power struggles with her own husband, her love of power, her love of her work, had not really been translated, because there's so many impenetrable myths that have been set up around her. And I kind of wanted to uncover a lot of those and really get to who she was.
You see, right there, her love of power. I always had this image of Queen Victoria as someone who fell into a stage of extended grief when her husband died and lost all interest in being Her Britannic Majesty, Empress of India, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
Is that not true?
That's one of the things that drives me completely crazy. And it's funny, because I was in my recent trip in London, like, this is what even cab drivers say to me. I'm like, so what do you think about Victoria? He's like, well, she was pretty useless after Albert died.
So she lost her man and lost all interest in life. Right.
Well, yeah, and actually I've just been going through recently the letters that are not there in the official collections. Now, the vast bulk of people do not have access to those kind of, to the Royal Archives. And the letters that aren't there are the ones that kind of tell a completely different story. And actually I was just looking at a PhD which was arguing that a lot of, you know, that there's a strong narrative of men influencing her and dominating her throughout her life. So you miss her love of power. You miss what Lady Lyttelton, who ran her royal nursery, used to call the vein of iron running through her character. A lot of biographies end when he died. Now, she ruled for 40 years on her own, and it's assumed that she kind of got around rather stout and grumpy in that time and never really got out and did much. Now, it is true, she mourned loudly and long. Her heart was completely broken. If there's ever a woman who loved a man, she loved him in every single way, and he was everything to her. He was almost like, you know, husband, she lost her father when she was 8 months old. Husband, father, she was estranged from her mother, so her mother as well. He did everything. Like, he was a beyond a Renaissance man, Albert. And she was terribly alone, as kind of Tennyson said to her, you're so alone on that terrible height. And when Albert died, she cried, there's no one to call me Victoria now. You know, and so I get that, and I felt this real empathy. I was in the London Library, British Library, going through. There's a little journal there where she's kept scraps of poems that sustained her after he died. And she had written in the margins, you know, my angel, and she'd underlined this bit. And I felt this enormous empathy for how much grief she felt. But what that then meant was that she then went on to create an enormous myth about Albert the Good, Albert the Brilliant, Albert the Perfect, and diminished herself in the process. You know, it was almost in her own interest to say, oh, women aren't meant for governing, but I do not want you to be prime minister. You should be sacked as archbishop and let's go to war. You know, it
was that she hiding in plain sight in that way? Are you saying
yes,
she adopted this persona of being disinterested,
yes,
or uninterested and disinterested in power, which was her way of exercising power?
In a way, but she would say women are not meant for governing. I mean, the women's suffrage, those women, she just used to absolutely infuriate her. She said one of them should just get a big spanking. You know, she said in her
She wanted her to spank Emily Pankhurst, did
yeah,
she?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, but at the same time, there were many opportunities for her, for example, to share some of her responsibilities with her elder son. Never, didn't want to do it, not interested. Like she wanted to rule, and she wanted to rule from when she was a teenager. She wanted it very much, and she kind of held on to those responsibilities. When she was pregnant, suffering on and off with postnatal depression, it was kind of a different story, and that's something that was never told. You read these biographies, and they're like, oh, and then there was a Crimean War, and another child popped out, and then this happened, and another child popped out. You're like, hang on a second, you know. She almost never took any time off. There was no maternity leave for the Queen.
At the start of the First World War, it was said that... And this is true. The King of Great Britain, the German Kaiser, and the Russian Tsar had one thing in common. They were all grandchildren of Queen Victoria.
Yes.
How many children did Queen Victoria have, Julia?
Nine. And amazingly, for those times, amazingly, they all survived. Her counterparts did not. A lot of her peers did not. You know, the childhood mortality rate was very, very high, so much so that by the end of the 19th century, 80% of parents took out insurance against their children, which wasn't really such a great thing because people worried that led to infanticide, of course. I shouldn't laugh. It's awful because so many, and in fact, I was reading recently about how cherubs were so prolific then because that, in a way, so many people used to grieve babies all the time. That is where the cherub came from. What is astonishing about Victoria is that all of her children survived. She was incredibly robust throughout it. And I think because there's so much about, you know, pregnancy affecting women's brains and they couldn't function properly, Albert in particular was always like, nope, she's good, she's back on it, she's out of her bed, you know.
This means she spent something like 81 months of her life in pregnancy. What did she write in her letters about being pregnant and that experience and childbirth?
That is the golden question, because her letters to other women are not included in her official records. And that is what has distorted, you know, the way we understand her as a mother. She had a very complicated relationship about her children. Like, she was very, she had this almost Jensen, she didn't like the physicality of it. She felt like a cow or a pig. She refused to breastfeed. She thought it was disgusting. You know, when her daughter Alice decided to nurse herself, she was so affronted that a heifer in the dairy was suddenly named Princess Alice. but she, I think throughout her life, I think she was one of these women who loved her husband to the expense of many other things. Like, she got much more pleasure from the company of Albert than from the company of her nine children. She saw herself as someone who would regulate their lives and scold them. It wasn't till they got older. When they were infants and then when they were adults, she really kind of got a lot of pleasure from them. But she had a complicated relationship with her kids.
Was there a power struggle between her and Albert? Was there a kind of an expectation that Albert as the royal consort might actually rule?
I think, well, let's not forget, he came from Coburg, from a, you know, principality in Germany, where women weren't allowed to rule, you know, in Hanover. I mean, Victoria was the first, you know, monarch for some time to be just the monarch of England. But previously, it was this, you know, it was of Hanover and it was of England. So they had to split it and give it to the next man in line, the German responsibility. So I think Albert was surrounded by men who said, yes, absolutely, he should be taking over her rules. And everyone thought it would, her responsibility, everyone thought that would be a natural consequence. What was not known at the time she married him was that he was brilliant. Like, he was brilliant.
What do you think it was like to live at that time? Even for, obviously, a woman living in what was a state of extreme comfort by the standards of the time. Yes. Are you going to try and recreate that sense of living in that period, the Victorian period?
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. That's what I'm determined to do more than almost anything apart from get to the heart of who Victoria is. But, you know, we talk about extreme comfort, but even the palaces had, you know, all these overflowing toilets. I mean, that's another thing. Albert did everything, as I keep telling you, but he sorted out the sewage system, which was one of the things. The palace, Buckingham Palace, used to be run by three different government departments. One would set the fires, another would light it, one would do the inside of the windows, one would do the outside. One year Victoria asked as a birthday present if the windows could be cleaned at the same time. Kensington Palace was infested with beetles, and there was a sewage problem outside Victoria's bedroom in Buckingham Palace. So yes, of course it was granted. She had enormous wealth, comparatively at a time of, the Industrial Revolution. But, they still had to deal with very basic problems like that. And London at that time, and I have been a little bit obsessed with the smell of it because, in 1856, it stank. Once they started to actually work out that you shouldn't just have the sewage in your little pools under your house, let's flow it down to the river, the Thames was disgusting. Once upon a time, there were salmon swimming there, people could fish there, but it became this completely septic. And in 1856, there was the Great Stink, where people couldn't go anywhere near it, and they had to bleach these, enormous sheets and pin them around the Houses of Parliament. All these lords and members of Parliament pinching their noses and vomiting as they were, because the stench was so bad.
Disraeli walking around with a nose peg.
Yes, that's right.
Gladstone sort of not being able to hold it down.
It got really, really bad. There were a lot of extremely urgent social reforms due to the population explosion, in London. So, yeah, just walking around, What it would have looked like to walk through the streets of London has kind of obsessed me a bit.
You spent these years in America. What was your first taste of America as a kid, Julia?
Yeah, when I was a child, we moved there when I was seven. We were there for a few years. My father was working there, and we were in New York, and in a town
like
called
Manhattan, or
a town upstate in a town called Rye, which is near Westchester, which was really wonderful, in terms of a sense of a community. And I think as a kid, the things that you really love, are the kind of the snow and the seasons, and also things like Halloween, which for us just seems like often a grotesque ritual of giving children a lot of sugar. Mm-hmm. But when you grow up there, it's about everyone kind of coming out and being creative and doing different things. My best friend and I used to paint the same window in the local stationers every year, and there was competition. So everyone had their own pane of glass throughout the town. And, it was a time where we recognised that community. But I also, America for me was a place of great pride and opportunity, I think. I just absorbed that optimism.
And as a kid?
As a kid. Not opportunity for me physically. But, it's a place where you stand up in the morning and you pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands.
Did you have to do that?
I refused for some time, and then I did. Yes, absolutely. And then you sing the Star Spangled Banner or a couple of other songs, and the patriotism is really infectious. It's like, I am proud to be American. My best friend's name was Erica, and she used to always say, I am Erica. And I was like, wow, that's so clever and cool. but yeah, I do think that you pick up on those things as a kid.
When you came to work in of course at the Sydney Morning Herald and became a columnist, and you left Australia in 2005 to go to the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Wow. What did you think of being in the company of all those bright sparks, the future leaders of America, Julia?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty amazing. Harvard I was completely amazed by, obviously, for so many obvious reasons. The enormous resources, the talent of the teaching staff. And also, I was talking about, pledging allegiance to the flag, but there's a sense in the States that you just speak your mind and that everyone's got a view, and there's a kind of a boldness, I think in Australia we're often taught to speak about our corner or how things might affect Australia or have a global perspective on things. On my first day there, and I was jet lagged and freezing because I didn't have any of the right, it was so cold, it was like minus 20 degrees. And we all sat up in this, the Kennedy School. There were five fellows and we were sitting in this room, and I could see all these political experts and gurus and professors around the table. And then the man standing next to me, running the Shorenstein Center, said, okay, so as you all know, this is our welcome to our fellows, and we like to kick this off with a discussion after our lunch every week. And I'd like to talk about Iraq and our progress in Iraq and where we think America's at. So, Julia, if you would like to kick off. And I was like, of course I followed this, but there are so many people around this room who know so much more than me, you know, and in a way I had to learn not to self-deprecate all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing we do. Is we go, oh, well, I don't know. You shouldn't ask me, and I don't really know. But
yeah.
Yeah. So you did a bit of that.
Or we constantly had to introduce ourselves, and you can't put yourself down because they will believe you. People will be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Your book just, no one read it. And I'll be like, oh, no. I was like, it was fine. You know, so that was a cultural thing. And I always tell people to be careful of that when they're going for jobs and things too, because it's just our cultural tick. You know?
To just go, well, I'm nothing special, but yeah, here I am anyway, that kind of thing. Yeah. How did that that period at Harvard lead you then from there to Newsweek?
Well, I was working on this research project about American... I've been running the op-ed page for the Herald, and I was interested in which Americans were being reprinted around the world and when in the lead-up to the Iraq War. Like, how was that fueling a debate in the newspapers of their allies? And I was trying to meet a bunch of columnists with varying degrees of success. I ended up interviewing Maureen Dowd, and then 3 days later was gambling in Vegas with her, which, by the way, is so America. You know.
You went gambling in Las Vegas with Maureen Dowd? Did you win?
No, we were terrible. And we kept getting on the big roller tables by accident. And so we just did a little bit of the pokies and went back to the bar and drank dirty martinis. But she was... That's exactly what you would hope would happen, right, when you meet someone as amazing as Maureen Dowd. And I also – and she took me to meet Tom Friedman, and that was in Berkeley, and he had just arrived by Google helicopter at this event, which he'd just done something with Robin Williams. And it was so extraordinary. And then there was a person down the hall from me at Harvard. His name was Evan Thomas. He was the managing editor of Newsweek. He's a biographer. He's very, very clever, and he was helping me. He's the one that introduced me to Maureen. And honestly, he said, you have to come in and talk to us, and you have to come and meet this. There's a young, brilliant editor called John Meacham, and you should go and meet him. And so I went to New York and I met him, and we talked for hours, actually, weirdly, about the Second World War, which I didn't know he was an expert in. Otherwise, I would have been much more daunted by that particular conversation. And he asked me to come and work there.
Does it feel like you're at the centre of the world when you work for, you know, a magazine like Newsweek in New York?
It does to the extent, well, especially of the American world, and Australians are so interested in America, but it does to the extent that people will return your calls and they will write for you. And
like what kind of people?
Like Wolfowitz or Colin Powell, or, you know, they will just return your call.
You're ringing up Colin Powell and saying, I want you to write for me.
Yeah. I did that. And I got a series of creative pieces on the end of imagining the end of the war, actually, which was wonderful. But there's the buzz and energy and electricity and access to people is really thrilling. I think at the same time, you're still aware that they're, you know, in the Asian century, that America in some ways is in, you know, decline of its influence, but not its optimism, which is a tension I was always particularly interested in working there and reporting on the recession at the same time, because there's such an assumed buoyancy to the way Americans think about themselves and about their chances of recovery and world dominance. So, but I think I was also very conscious of that when I was there, of India and China and the enormous debt to China and how that's going to work over the long term and how Americans really, really, really need to grapple with that. A lot of people move to New York and they never really move again. And a lot of people don't take holidays there. I mean, they might get 2 weeks a year. I mean, you know, and senior staff at Newsweek got 4 weeks, but wouldn't, honestly, I can't tell you the number of people that just wouldn't take it.
Does that make New Yorkers leave. Strangely parochial?
I think so. Yeah, I do. And that's one of the reasons why I think everyone goes only in New York. I mean, and there's a lot of things that happen only in New York. But if we're talking about, I don't know, seeing a drag queen walking through the subway singing, I'm like, no, I've seen that on Oxford Street. You know, it's like, but no, you can't help but always having a sense of wonder in New York just because of, you know, the congregation of people there and the electricity of the debates. It's really, really contagious.
When I was there last year, I saw lots of signs of decline, shabbiness that you see, I kind of got used to when living in London, and I started to see it in New York for the first time. But the odd thing was New Yorkers didn't seem to be that aware of that.
No, that was true. And I remember when I moved back there, I was like, guys, the subway is really dirty. It's disgusting. And they were like, what do? You know, like, I mean, I know that most, you know, a lot of people take town cars and so on. But and then you go to Paris, where it's, you could eat from the subway walls. I mean, it's just so clean there. So I did notice things like that. But look, I mean, the recession was what was a massive shock to me. You come back to Australia and everyone was talking about the GFC, but there you go to a dinner party, half the people had lost their jobs. Almost every third shop on my block, you know, which was in the relatively affluent Upper West, had shut down, was being replaced. Downtown Tribeca was looking like a ghost town for a lot of it. And when I moved to Philadelphia, that, you know, the local library was shutting down 2 days a week. Lights in some counties were being turned off at certain periods, you know, street lights at night. The local pool was only open 4 weeks in summer instead of 6 or 8 weeks. You could see this kind of incremental stuff, which, you know, which kind of did really trouble me. But look, I think New York's got a very fragile infrastructure. I mean, you know, we saw what happened with the floods, but sometimes there'd be a hailstorm in Brooklyn and the whole subway is just turned down. So, you know, it's old, and probably some of it hasn't been invested in for some time.
On our side in Australia, we tend to caricature Americans a lot. What don't we get about Americans? What do we miss about them?
Yeah, I do kind of butt up against a lot of the freak show reporting that we see about America. You know, people always kind of tend to go to Texas and talk to, you know, people with strange views or extreme views. And I think that, and I do think that there can be a strong vein of anti-Americanism, partly because Australia's followed so, you know, not blindly, but often unquestioningly. We haven't asked enough questions and we haven't really been gratified about that. For example, our entry into the Iraq War. But to answer your question, what we don't get, I think that I find Americans very open, extremely generous. There's kind of a limitless sense of possibility. I mean, honestly, the difference between telling my friends in the States I was working on a book about Queen Victoria was like, oh, that's great. You're perfect for that. Oh, my God, this is going to be. And my Australian friends are like, mate, that's huge. How are you even going to get through? And I'm like, yeah, I know.
Best stop now.
Yeah, that's right. What are you doing?
Have a drink.
Yeah, that's, you know. And I do love that. And I also, like, I really enjoy the very vibrant ongoing debates about democracy and the seriousness about a culture of ideas there. And, you know, what is freedom? I mean, I think looking at what, I mean, I'm studying the monarchy now. I'm looking at privilege and aristocracy and the very gradual devolvement of, you know, power and votes to, the middle class during the 19th century. But 1776, it's unalienable right, you know, that all men were created equal. Didn't include slaves, of course, you know, didn't include women. But that was incredible. I think that as an intellectual legacy is huge. And they still argue about it today. I mean, like, the Tea Party looked like nutters, but they were asking very serious questions. What have you done with Wall Street? Why are you guys only looking after your own interests? You know,
how far should government be a part of our lives?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, although, you know, you notice little banners like hands off our Medicaid, which were a bit nuts, but,
Yeah, it's a government program.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, I think that we kind of, that we can sometimes miss or parody the seriousness and the importance of that. You know, I mean, so much so that, you know, a lot of their global intervention, again, highly controversial, but is about the status of democracy in other countries. So the right of an individual to participate in government, the American dream that Obama represents in a country riven by so many tensions and is, you know, so polarized by different hatreds, there's an African-American president, you know, who was brought up by a single mother and not in affluent circumstances.
The great American journalist Barbara Ehrenreich wrote this book, I think it was a couple of years ago, where she was railing against the American culture of positive thinking, the power of positive thinking. You see it, you want it, you go for it, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And the danger it presents to America, because it tends to, she said that it tends to blind them to bad things that are coming, like Hurricane Katrina, the attacks on the World Trade Center, which were kind of blithely set aside, sadly, by the administration at the time, and other things as well, the collapse of Wall Street. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think there's a lot of truth to it. As I said, there's something I really admire about it, about that buoyancy. But there was one point I was trying to pitch a story quite early on before Lehman Brothers had collapsed. There was just a few canaries in the mine kind of scenarios happening with the economy starting to look very wobbly. And I wanted to make a call and have a cover story called The End of the Second Gilded Age. You know, the first was a time of, you know, great prosperity, but big divide between the rich and poor. And I had majority support for it. Let's say it's such a, you know, that's what you have to do, really pitch and argue and defend and try to get your case up. Mind you, it's not always like that, but it certainly was for this. And a lot of pushback I got was, but I don't know if this is going to affect many people. I don't know if this is actually going to endure for very long. And I had to bite my lip not to come back to it and say, remember that cover story that I wanted to do after the recession? But and then we very quickly ran a piece calling it when it was over. And Fareed Zakaria was writing pieces saying...
Oh, the recession's over.
It was over. Well, that was called... I can't even remember when that was called. 2009 sometime. It was a cover story by Dan Gross. And Fareed Zakaria we kept running pieces by him saying, just remember America's capacity for innovation, and we have the immigration, and we have... Sure, all these things are bad, but we haven't lost our sense of, you know, our possibility. And I was really fascinated by that.
That story got up.
That's all. That was not a problem. But that's not to point to my own prescience or anything like that. It's more to say that I just noticed how ingrained it is, a sense that America can survive and resist and outcome everything, you know, overcome everything. And they did overcome a great recession, and they are immensely large and well-resourced, but there are also a lot of very deep structural problems that need to be addressed as we're looking now and facing a fiscal cliff, of course.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
I'm with Julia Baird today, a writer, journalist. Julia, in your time with Newsweek, you were sent out to cover the 2008 election. Two new stars appeared that year, Barack Obama and Sarah Palin. Give me a sense of what the environment, the atmosphere was like in the lead up to that election and that process, which began with the primaries.
Oh, it was so exciting. Everyone was expecting, though, when I got there, every single pundit I met was expecting it to be Giuliani and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were wrong. Everyone was wrong.
Everyone was very wrong. I mean, this whole Nate Silver debate about this election, it's like, no, pundits have always been wrong. In fact, there was a psychological study. What is it about the fox and the, it's not the weasel or something.
Hedgehog.
Thank you. And it's the people who are in the public eye, who work as pundits and who come to quick conclusions, are the most likely to get things wrong. So people who deliberate and stew and ponder. So anyway, that was way out. Although, you know, by the time it got to the debate, you know, between Hillary and Barack Obama, it was just amazing. You know, and we had, you know, the first woman or the first African-American, and it was really, really exciting and very gripping. And then but Sarah Palin was like a grenade into the whole show. You know, it was so unexpected.
Tell me about the first time you saw her speak.
Yeah, that was at the Democratic, the Republican National Convention. And we were all kind of rooted to our chairs because suddenly in she bounced and she was very articulate. You know, the grassroots of the party absolutely loved her. She was feisty and she was unabashed, that's for sure. Also untested, but she electrified, you know, the base in a very, very strong way. We thought she was going to have a really big impact on that election, and she did to some extent, but she just made so many mistakes so quickly. She just, so you know, wasn't up to it.
She made that killer speech, as you say. That's where she said, you know, about a hockey mom is, you know,
it's a pitbull with lipstick.
Pitbull with lipstick, yes. Yeah. And you can see the whole convention just erupt, and she had great comic timing for that. She's like Barack Obama; they both got really good comic timing. They can be quite funny.
She's a great performer
when they want to be. So, what did you think when you as that campaign developed, her position on some of the issues and how forceful she could be in advocacy of those things, but then the way she struggled to deal with some, you know, basic foreign policy issues.
What, yeah, no, she wasn't up to it. She just wasn't up to it. But she was very folksy and very popular, and I think also incredibly frustrating for a lot of very talented women in the Republican Party who could have done a much, much better job and be more substantive. The things that she was tripped up on, what magazines do you read? What newspapers do you read? I mean, that was kind of stunning. She opened herself to parody. I thought that some of the parody was a bit unfair. I mean, Tina Fey was brilliant.
Yeah. Hysterical, actually. Funny, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
But what about the fact that she was an attractive woman? She is an attractive woman. There is something about that that can make guys, maybe some women too, just not see straight. Did you find that?
Oh, yes. I mean, Margaret Thatcher used to not be able to make people, the men around her, see straight. I mean, there's not a lot of women in those arenas. And, you know, she was a former prom queen, and she was very attractive. I actually wrote a piece about the hotness of Republican women and how much obsession there was with them. there was, you know, after the midterms, and there was this like ladies' night. Wow, you know, and they've now got 2% of women, and you know, in that incoming. But
Ann Coulter, Ann Coulter, the Republican pundit, said at the time that hot girls are more likely to be Republicans.
Yes,
and Democrat women were dowdy, sort of knitting, right. Hippie chicks.
Yeah, they always talk about Elena Kagan, or they'll bring up old photos of Hillary, you know, as being earnest and intellectual. Yeah, that's right. And they were the sassy ones. But there's also some kind of offensive stuff which comes out from the left on that too, kind of, which, you know, you often excuse sexism when it comes from your own side. And then the weird, creepy, you know, hot stuff in Playboy that came out about those women too. And ultimately, I really just found that it's very trivializing. It's like, you know, we're not going to like drill for oil in Alaska. You know, we're just being sassy, or we're just being naughty. And I think that there was a bit of that. It's not just that they're trivialized. You forget the import of what they're doing and what they're saying. And again, she was one a few heartbeats away from the presidency. I mean, there were a lot of concerns about McCain's health.
Indeed. I read what you wrote about that Playboy article, which I think listed Sarah Palin as one of the women that guys want to have hate sex with. And I think you wrote after that just one word, moron. Is that, did that happen often in Newsweek? They'd get that kind of Australian kind of put down like that.
Oh, the moron thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. My editor used to call me the Margaret Mead of American politics. And I'd be like, really? Because, I mean, he said that to me after I wrote a piece about Hillary Clinton, saying, why do you guys all hate her, by the way? Because there was a book, 30 essays about Hillary by women. And it was all these hyper-educated Northeastern American women who didn't like her pantsuits. They just didn't like that she'd married Clinton, that she stayed with Clinton, that she was still married to Clinton, that, you know, like a cheating husband was somehow seen as, you know, a slur on her. But there were the games she played, the way she talked, her pantsuits, this whole lump of irrationality. There was not a single essay in there talking about her policies or what she might do strategically. And when he said that to me after that, I was like, that's so weird, because the hatred is visceral and irrational. So things like that. But I mean, but just going back to Sarah Palin, I mean, what I did do is go off and do a whole bunch of research on the way women vote and why we vote. And would that bounce that we got from Palin coming in, how would that translate into the polls? And it found, surprise, the last 100 years of women's voting, the economy is the number one, you know, driving factor of the way women vote, you know.
In fact, women by and large, I think historically, have tended to be voted more conservatively than men by and large. I think over time that tends to be.
Right.
And the argument put forward is that women, they often do the accounts in the family. They're often got an idea, close eye on who's going to do the money.
They know what's going in and out.
Things.
Exactly. Yeah. And do a lot of the budgeting. I mean, it hasn't been conservative maybe for the past four or so decades. And of course, Obama's got a huge gender gap now. But I do think it's interesting. The stuff about Hillary and Palin just was, I was completely gripped.
Every year or so, it seems, there's a major article in a major American magazine, usually written by a woman, that has the kind of as its theme, feminism lied to me, it promised me I could have it all.
Mm.
What really gets up your nose about these kinds of things, Julia?
What doesn't get up my nose? I mean, look, the very question in and of itself. Firstly, that there's some group of feminists who say, you know what, you know, sign up for a job and a baby and the world, you'll soon be drinking cocktails by a lagoon.
Have it all.
You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I just do not know a single man, if you said, you know, who said, oh, my wife and I have just had a baby and I'm employed. They'd go, oh, my God, I have everything I could ever need. I tend to think that if you ask men what having it all would mean, it would involve, you know, a chalet in France and, you know, maybe their own tropical island. And it's this sense that built into the idea of mothers working is something unrealistic and greedy and grasping. And it's existed since the time I've been looking at, since Victorian England, this pushback on. And it's just another form of grilling working mothers for wanting more than is their due or is their share. And it's just couched in this crazy language, because, of course, we struggle and it's a juggle and there's guilt. I mean, that's just natural. And by the way, more and more men are feeling that too. You know, there should be an ongoing tension and debate between what employers demand and what our children need. Like, that's just necessary, because these are, you know, your children are the most important thing, but you need to pay your bills. So the fact that that's gendered, I think, does men and women a disservice.
Yeah. What about the very idea that anyone could promise you could have it all anyway? Who would believe that you could ever have it all in this life? No one ever has it all, ever.
I know. The human experience is about one of, like, you know, reaching for possibilities but yet understanding your own limitations, you know.
Do you think that feminism ever made that promise, or is this
never
a straw man?
I've never read it anywhere. Never. I mean, what kind of woman would be so, you know, smug and assuming. Because the only way to ever say that is if you've got a lot of money. Queen Victoria kind of had it all, didn't she, really? She was the Queen of England.
She still had to knock out nine kids, though, didn't she, as part of her job?
And yeah. It was really hard on her body, and she only had anaesthetics for the last one. There was not very much understanding about contraception. She never had that chance. She always wanted more time to have sex with Alba, but she couldn't because she didn't breastfeed. She didn't have a natural contraceptive. Anyway, so...
Did you ever have that childish expectation as a young woman that you could have it all?
No. I remember Margaret Thatcher becoming... you know, the Prime Minister of England. I remember that. And having that discussion about, you know, that women could do what they wanted. But I always had a sense, no. But see, that's because as a little kid, you don't think about sitting around and saying, I have it all. But do you want to have children? Yeah. Do you want to, you know, use your abilities and try to be the best you can be with what you've got? Yeah. But that's not... having it all. I really resent the fact that there at graduation days or at speech days there'll be people saying, now girls, think about whether or not you can have it all, because I can guarantee you that little boys aren't being told to compress their horizons before they've even got out of their school uniforms yet.
The other article that gets published every year or so is this one. Feminism promised to make women happy and it's just made them or us miserable. How about that one?
Do you know what? I mean, I think that's bollocks. That's like saying, you know, is having rights, the access to work, to not being discriminated against, to being paid fairly, to, you know, not being abused, to standing up as an autonomous individual, has that made you unhappy? Or is oppression maybe the whole, you know, a nice dish of dessert that you'd like to sup on? But there is actually a really interesting issue around that, whereas people have tracked in America happiness over the past, you know, three decades. Women's happiness has gone down since the 1970s. And I think that's really interesting, except for African-American women. And there's a whole... and that's something I kind of spent quite a bit of time looking at when I was at Newsweek. And it's actually Justin Wolfers, an Australian economist, who's done that research. And the natural and ridiculous assumption is to then say, oh, therefore it's because of feminism. I think it's a whole bunch of other factors.
Julia, how can anyone possibly do a survey on how people were happier in the 70s than the present day?
Yes.
How can you ever gauge such a thing? How can you rely on honest answers to any kind of survey to that sort of thing?
Oh, that's interesting. I think that if you've got, I think the comparative data goes back to the early 70s. I think that's what they've got. If you ask people the same questions over a period of time. But before that, it gets a bit wobbly. And then there's a wellbeing index and a happiness index and all the rest of it. And what does it mean to be happy?
I know. And could you call it an honesty index?
No,
I
know.
Well, I know maybe people are more inclined to tell the truth about how unhappy they are. Right. They may have not in the 1970s.
But also, I think that's right. But also, like, what is happiness? There's a lot of talk about whether parents are happy, you know, because at that point in your life, most surveys show that the period in which you're bringing up children, having young children, is the least happy of your life. I kind of disagree with the fact that it's almost like asking what you would like to do on an hourly basis. Right now, would you be like to be, you know, like cleaning up some nappies or wiping vomit off the sink? Not pretty much. I'd like to be reading a book by the ocean, but should we really be asking what's giving you a deep sense of contentment or fulfillment? Those kinds of things. And I that's what we're going back to your earlier point about happiness. I think that's often what we get wrong, that we need to be buff and high and, you know, or really whether, as Eleanor Roosevelt said, whether happiness is, you know, is a byproduct. It happens when you focus on other things that mean something to you.
And do you think that's right? Do you think it's a byproduct of your activity? Yes.
Yeah. I think that if you focus less on yourself and you look outwards and you live a life that means something, I think happiness is definitely a byproduct of that.
Famously, in the Declaration of Independence in the United States, you know, Jefferson writes the inalienable rights, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's
yes.
another original thing that appears. The whole idea that one could have an expectation or a right to pursue happiness is a kind of original idea. It's something that Russians often say, I don't know what they're talking about. We expect to suffer, you know.
Yes.
What do you think about that whole idea? Is it a specifically American thing here? Do you think we have it here too, this expectation that we're in pursuit of happiness?
Yes, I do. I think that we have that expectation now too. I think books on happiness go through the roof. There's no happiness institutes, courses, disciplines. But my editor actually told me when we were debating that once, The Pursuit of Happiness, that actually, and he's just got a biography of Jefferson, which has just come out, The Art of Power, that phrase meant the pursuit of money, actually.
Because Jefferson was a gloomy bastard, wasn't he?
Yeah, anyway. I know. Yes. very clever, very gloomy. So, you know, and that's probably a different debate in itself, and whether, you know, money or some kind of financial stability gives you happiness. But
do you have an ingrained, personally, an ingrained expectation of being happy, or something, an expectation of something else?
It's an interesting question. Yeah, I think you do. I think that you, as I said, it's kind of like if you're engaged in something meaningful, you don't want to feel like you've got like a toad of gloom squatting, you know, on your head. Put it completely inelegantly like that. Maybe free of misery is what you hope to be, but I think you also need to accept that there's, you know, you. I think if you can be happy, if you're philosophical about life as well. If you always expect to be up, then you won't be able to cope with... We've now pathologized sadness and anxiety. I had dinner with a whole bunch of my friends in Manhattan in January, and I was talking about... There was some talk, I don't know if it ended up coming out in the Jodie Cantor book, about Michelle Obama being on antidepressants, or whether she was on antidepressants and had Tipper Gore given them to her, all this discussion. And I was like... you know, it's funny, everyone being on antidepressants, and every single person at the table, since they're a teenager... had been on some kind of medication for anxiety, or maybe switched them halfway through. That troubles me, you know. I think that you need to be cognizant of and comfortable with the breadth of human experience. Otherwise, you're just going to think you're a failure if you feel sad or if something doesn't work out. I mean, we've got to be able to accept that, I think.
What signs do you see that men are adjusting to the new realities of women in the workforce and women trying to, you know, torn between these... two imperatives or many imperatives in their lives. Do you think you're seeing signs that men are managing this or taking some steps towards women in this regard?
A lot of signs. I see a lot of my friends taking paternity leave or taking a year off sometimes, 6 months off, trying to get some kind of flexibility so they can spend a day a week. I've got a bunch of friends who are at home, you know, who are at home a day a week and their partner is at home a day, and so they only have to sort out childcare for 3 days. The stats I was looking at in the States were really about, like, it's been a dramatic increase in guilt for the Gen Y man, but also, and I think Gen X too, but also I do think we can see accompanying changes in behaviour. That's what the debate about, you know. I can't even say the words work-life balance because it drives me crazy. It's all become cliched, you know. And it seems like it's impossible, but I do think that it'll be the generation of men coming through that will show that it's not, that you build that into your negotiations. Maybe less a salary and more, you know, being able to knock off one afternoon a week to, you know, pick your kids up from school. It's crucial. I think that built into our romanticising of the and glorification of the role of mothering, which I think is wonderful in many senses, but I think built into that is that we haven't traditionally acknowledged the importance of the role of the father.
Can I tell you an observation I've made about men? There are certain men who may have a certain view about what's correct, what the correct role of women is amongst their contemporaries, their wives, their girlfriends, their whatever. But when it comes to their daughters, they want the best of everything for their daughters.
Yeah, right.
They want their daughters to be full participants in everything that life has to offer. I wonder if that's had a role in changing the minds of some men about what's appropriate for women to do and where they should be.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think it's always a weak spot in any father's psyche.
Again and again and again.
But, of course, that's going to change your mind. And I think once you become, you know, aware of barriers and hurdles and discrimination that could stop your child from flying, you know, in the direction they want to or can, I think that's going to trouble any father. You want them to then translate it into the workforce they're in, of course.
We've just had the 2012 presidential election, which you watched from a distance this time round. Paul McGough, the journalist, once told me, he's based in Washington now, he said that the interesting thing about American politics as opposed to Australia is nothing ever gets resolved. Issues that you thought were long buried pop up again. And in the 2012 election, we saw some interesting comments made by Senate candidates regarding issues about rape and abortion, and that popped up. Mm. Were you surprised when that happened?
No, because I've seen look, it's the Tea Party bringing it into the mainstream, and they were absolutely hammered for it. I was surprised that they were so hammered for it, that those men were so decisively kicked out of their, you know, their seats. They didn't win, and I think this election heralded changes in a lot of ways. You know, the votes on gay marriage, you know, and the first lesbian senator to Obama getting back in, and to a real, a very strong sense that you can't say dismissive and ignorant things about women and not be penalised for it. And I thought, actually, that was kind of huge. You know, the fact that there's a debate about Planned Parenthood, I mean, I was there and visited our local clinics in Philadelphia and wrote a column about it for The Inquirer. It has a very, very small proportion, like, I don't know, 2% of its work, is abortion, and that's funded separately. The rest of it is for, you know, basic sexual health, for going for pap smears, for mammograms, for contraception. And the continued talk of just eradicating that makes absolutely no sense, because it wouldn't, you know, it, as I said, the kind of like the whole termination is funded completely separately. But I was pretty uncomfortable with a lot of the things that were said about women and during that election campaign.
An interesting phenomenon in the last election is that candidates felt they could lie with impunity. We seem to have gone beyond,
I know, beyond truthiness.
Yeah, beyond like the kind of spinning the truth, but telling outright lies.
Yes.
Having the lies, just saying things that are outright not true.
Yes.
In any objective sense of the word, being pulled up on it occasionally by the media, and then going right on ahead, yeah, and continuing to crash through that gate and continue to lie.
Yeah.
What do you think that says about the power of the news media in the United States these days?
Well, a lot of news media will be promulgating those lies as well, you know. So, and it's also a pushback on some of the media. So if you're going to get fact-checked by, I don't know, Politico, there's a lot of people that won't be reading that. And if you say something, you know, often enough, people, I mean, a very high percentage of people believe that Obama, you know, is a Muslim and was not born in the United States. And an even higher percentage of Americans think not only that they were, that their aliens exist, but they or a friend has been abducted by an alien. You know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, crazy myths out there. They're not related. But I do think the idea of just repeating something ad nauseum, it's really troubling. It's a very troubling precedent.
Our politicians watch their politicians very closely. Do you think we'll start seeing it here?
Truthiness?
Lies. I mean, out-and-out lies that get called out but don't seem to matter. The calling out doesn't seem to matter.
It would just be such a phenomenal shame were that to happen. You would hope, in a way, this is one way in which the fact that Australia's got a smaller media and it's not as niche as the US, there would be enough airing of the fact that these are lies, you know, to act as some kind of disincentive for that.
There was a lot of concern about the power of money in that presidential election. Mm. $2.7 billion, I think, went into political, yep, action committees. Many of that money was put in anonymously, effectively, so no one, yes, really knew where the money was coming from. That money was used to bombard the people of Ohio with ad after ad after, mm-hmm, ad. It didn't seem to work in a lot of cases.
Well, except the early bombing by the, you know, Obama super PACs creating the narrative about Romney and, you know, what he did at Bain Capital and he being the man who's most likely to sack your father and workers being without pensions. That was very, very successful early on. But yeah, I think it basically didn't have as much impact as people hoped. A lot of money spent, but you know what? There's always been a lot of money spent in American political elections. You know, I think Citizens United, the outcome of that court case is kind of disappointing, because we'll see more and more money funneled anonymously into advertising. But I think what was actually really significant was that there was no public funding used for this. Obama was the first to turn that down in 2008. McCain took it. This year, neither of them did. So they were able to, you know, raise the money themselves.
Newsweek is coming to an end that's very, very, very painful at the moment.
Yes.
How much of a surprise to you was that, the announcement that the print edition was going to disappear at the end of this year?
That was not a surprise at all. I mean, look, when we were clearly in financial trouble, you don't need to change an editor. The problem wasn't the number of subscriptions. The problem wasn't how pretty our articles were. The problem was the business model. And that's the same across the media. We had a high amount of our income coming from advertising, which went into a slump. And it's enormously expensive to print and distribute a magazine. Just to print Newsweek alone is $42 million. So Tina Brown's a great editor. I think John Meacham was a great editor as well. But unless you radically change where you're going to get money from in order to uphold the sheer expense of, and don't forget, we were with the Washington Post Company. It was the only magazine they were printing. Time is with, you know, Time Warner. Yeah. And they print a whole host of magazines, so they can share a lot of those backroom costs. So that was a very, very strong disadvantage for Newsweek, but incredibly frustrating if you have millions and millions of readers worldwide that we weren't properly able to monetize it.
Tina Brown, you mentioned there, former editor of Vanity Fair and The New Yorker, was the final editor of Newsweek, and she's just in this interview where she talked about the end of empire feel of it. She said in its heyday it had 30 bureaus all over the world, Newsweek, and
yes,
they're all gone now. Did it have that kind of end of empire feel to it when you were there, that sense of shrinking within its borders?
It was, when I arrived, that was still, it's pretty much still alive everywhere. I mean, it had a staggering presence, staggering amount of money was spent. We spent $1 million on our election project, which is when we send out reporters on planes. They go and report with the various candidates. They don't say anything to us for an entire year, but they report to one man, Evan Thomas, who writes it all up for the election, on the eve of the election. Incredibly expensive, fantastic journalism. When I was there, all of that still was going on, and I saw it in full flight. But it was precipitous, what happened with the recession, the cuts we had to make, and the sheer, the sheer size of the structural problem of the cost of producing that magazine.
How will election coverage change now? I mean, it'll have to shrink rapidly right across the board in journalism, won't it?
The appetite for journalism has not changed, which is what's incredibly encouraging. You know, I mean, I think Twitter and I think a lot of Politico and a lot of the online sites are doing fantastic journalism. But, you know, with the closing of Newsweek, the reason that I feel sad about it, for a whole bunch of reasons, but it's, you know, you want those resources to still be funneled to those gun investigative reporters that are going to get behind the scenes and report things that otherwise wouldn't be told. So, yeah.
Wonderful having you on the program, Julia. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.